This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm very fortunate today to be able to interview Professor Martin Rees, who's come to the University of Manchester for a celebration of a Nobel Prize that's been given to researchers here. We might have a bit of time to talk about that later, but I thought we would perhaps talk to you about what sort of things interest you in your own research at the moment.
Well, I'm really interested in two areas of research. One is objects called gamma-ray bursts, which are the most extreme explosions we know in the universe, where about a billion times as much energy as the sun puts out is put out in a tiny fraction of the sun's lifetime, just a few seconds sometimes. And these objects are very important because they allow us to study physics under very extreme conditions. And there seem to be two types of gamma-ray bursts. One is probably due to two neutron stars in a binary, rather like the famous binary pulsar that studied Jodrell Bank, which eventually will get so close under gravitational radiation effects that they will merge. And in that merger, a huge amount of energy is suddenly released in the form of very hard radiation and gamma rays. There's another kind of gamma-ray burst that's thought to be a kind of supernova, when a very big star ends its life and its core implodes. Now, normally in a supernova, the energy produced in the implosion doesn't get straight out. It's, as it were, muffled, and it comes out after a few days, degrades into visible light in the famous supernova light curve. But if the star that becomes a supernova is a spinning star, then the energy released in the implosion finds an easy way out, as it were, by forcing a jet opening along the axis. And so the energy in the form of hard radiation is emitted along the axis in a sort of narrow cone. And if you are in the line of sight of that narrow cone, then you are zapped with very intense gamma rays.
Okay.
And the gamma rays are so intense that they can detect it even at very high redshifts. And indeed, the optical emission from a gamma ray burst, although it's a tiny fraction of the gamma ray emission, is so intense that it's almost a naked eye object, even at a redshift of 2, when the brightest other objects like quasars are about 10 magnitudes fainter.
So a redshift of 2 is something like, I'm going guessing a bit here, but is it about 2 billion light years distant?
It's really more than that. It's about 10 billion light years.
10 billion, right.
And looking back probably about two-thirds or three-quarters of the time to the Big Bang. So these objects are not only fascinating in their own right because they're extreme physics, but also they are very good probes of the high redshift universe. And indeed the most distant, really firmly established object in the universe is a gamma-ray burst with a redshift of 8.2. And that's really looking back a long way. And so what this tells us is that galaxies have already formed and they produced massive stars of the kind that end their lives as gamma ray bursts right back then. And this links to my other area of research interest, which is the formation of the first galaxies. We know, of course, that the universe started off in a hot Big Bang, and after about 500,000 years, the radiation cooled down and entered the infrared, and the universe became literally dark after about 500,000 years, when the primordial radiation shifted to the infrared. And it remained dark until the first stars formed and lit it up again. And we'd like to know when that happened and what sort of galaxies these stars were in. We think that the first galaxies to form were really much smaller than present-day ones, and they formed when the universe was a few 100 million years old. And we'd like to find some probes of them. And the gamma-ray bursts are interesting not only because they're fascinating in their own right, but because they are probes of this early time. And this leads to another of my interests, which is another way of probing the very high redshift universe. And this is something which is very much studied here at Jodrell Bank. And this is studying intergalactic gas by the 21 centimeter line. This is a famous spectral line emitted by neutral hydrogen, which is one of the main probes for where neutral hydrogen gas is found in our galaxy. Now, it's possible with a sufficiently powerful telescope, and in the long run, a telescope called the Square Kilometre Array is going to be able to do this.
It's a radio telescope.
A radio telescope, and this will be able to detect the 21 centimetre line from very, very distant gas. And what we'd like to know is when the intergalactic gas, which would of course have cooled down as the universe expanded, gets heated up again by the first energy input from the first stars and quasars. We think this happened when the universe was about a billion years old, and we don't quite know when it happened. But the study of this 21 centimeter line with the square kilometer array will be able to tell us when the ionization happened, when the first stars and first quasars formed and provided enough heat to re-ionize the gas. And so you will expect to see at very, very high redshifts lots of neutral gas, and then at some transition redshift you will find that the amount of neutral gas diminishes, which is all then heated up and become ionized.
But we don't quite know, I suppose, until it's observed exactly how it's going to be, or is it something
that's already we don't know. We have another indication, because when we look in visible light at quasars, we see absorption effects due to intergalactic gas along the line of sight, and the amount of absorption tells us how much neutral hydrogen there is. And at recent epochs, low redshifts, the neutral hydrogen fraction is very small compared to the ionized fraction. It's very highly ionized, but it's interesting that when we get out to the very most distant quasars, which have redshifts about 6, which means that the wavelengths are stretched by a factor of 7 between emission and reception, then the proportion of neutral hydrogen seems to go up. And so it looks as though there is an important era in cosmic history, which is called the epoch of reheating or reionization, which is the epoch when there was enough energy input from the first stars and galaxies to heat up all the gas in the universe that hasn't yet made it into stars and make it ionized, which means heating it to a temperature of at least 10,000 degrees.
It almost sounds like a recipe. This particular step, these particular ingredients are sort of being put into the mix and creating the next generation of stars.
Well, that's right. What happens is that the gas goes into stars, and then of course some of those stars die as supernovae, some even more spectacularly as gamma ray bursts, and the ones that die as supernovae of course expel the processed material whereby in their lifetime they've synthesized many of the elements of the periodic table, and it is those heavy elements which condense into new stars, and of course that's how the heavy elements in the solar system and in us were formed. And it's interesting, when we look at the most distant galaxies we can see, spectroscopic analysis allows us to estimate what proportion of their material is in the form of the so-called heavy elements, that's things other than hydrogen and helium, and it's a lower proportion there than in a present-day galaxy, and that's what you'd expect, because the process of synthesizing the periodic table has only just got started, and there hasn't been enough time to build up the proportion of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, etc., which we see now. And so even if you could look with a huge telescope at these very high redshift galaxies, none of their stars would have planets, because to make planets you obviously need to have things to make rocks, carbon, oxygen, phosphorus, etc., and there'd be no planets around these stars in these very distant galaxies.
Mm. So gamma ray bursts are obviously very transient events. They come and go quite quickly. How can you catch these things as they happen, or rather as we see them happen?
Well, there have been several spacecraft which have been launched in order to detect gamma ray bursts. They look at the whole sky, and they can pin down the position of these gamma ray bursts. And the SWIFT satellite, which was launched about 6 years ago by NASA, is able to pin down the positions accurately enough and quickly enough that follow-up observations can be made with other telescopes. And although the gamma ray telescope doesn't have very good resolution, then if you can look with an optical telescope, you can pin down to 1 second of arc where it is and identify it and see what sort of galaxy it's in and perhaps get an estimate of its distance. So there are all-sky surveys which pin down gamma ray bursts, and they are popping up about one per day. When the position is pinned down well enough by detecting the gamma rays, then you can deploy even quite small optical telescopes and follow up the light curve and the so-called afterglow, whereby it gradually fades away. And this allows you also to pin down its position and see what sort of galaxy it's in.
Well, having had the Nobel Prize ceremony, we've had the chance to just pick up the interview for a moment or two. Mm-hmm. So what I thought I'd ask you about next was some of the books that you've written for a popular audience. There seem to be two themes to those. One is the physical laws that underpin the universe, and the other one is the future of humanity. Are those two things that you think sort of naturally go together?
Well, I'm a university teacher, and the subject I teach are physics and astronomy, and as well as teaching undergraduates and graduate students, I give quite a lot of general talks to the public, because I think we're lucky in our subject that there's wide public interest. And through this, I accumulated quite a lot of popular articles and lecture notes, and I felt it was worth making the effort of getting them in book form. And I produced five books on astronomy. I've never started with a blank sheet of paper. I'm not a natural writer, but I did these books by meshing together various articles and things I'd written. And so that's how my astronomy books got written. But also, as part of my work, I've always had an interest outside science in what you might call global problems, arms control, and what's going to happen in the coming decades, etc. And that's another subject which I often give talks about. I think it's important to make students, whatever subject they're studying, aware of these broader issues, because they're going to grow up in a world that's going to change over the rest of their lives. And so I often give talks and participate in discussions and write articles on these general themes. And as an outcome of that activity, I produced a book which was called Our Final Century.
That's quite a dramatic title.
Well, I called it Our Final Century question mark, right. And the publishers took the question mark away. But what I was really addressing were problems that are going to confront us in this century, because although the Earth's been around for 45 million centuries, this one is special, because it's the first when one species, namely ours, has the future of the planet in its hands. And so it is really the case that what humans do collectively to the planet in the next 100 years is going to affect the entire future of the planet. And the other thing astronomy teaches us, of course, is that the time lying ahead is at least as long as the time that's elapsed up till now. The sun is less than halfway through its life. And so this special century is going to determine the fate of the planet for another 40 or 50 million centuries.
Do you think we could last that long as a species? I suppose that's the question.
Well, I think the question is how we get through this present century, and are some people by then living away from the Earth? Are we starting to modify ourselves by genetic technology? I think we've got to bear in mind that 4 or 5 billion years is longer than it's taken us to evolve from the simplest life. So if we ask what sort of life would be around when the Earth ends, they won't be human.
No.
Because there'll be far more time in future. And of course that statement is even more true, because evolution in future will happen not on the million year time scale of Darwinian selection of species to evolve and become extinct, but on a much shorter time scale perhaps, on which we can technologically change human beings by genetic modification, or perhaps on a scale of time when robots and silicon-based organisms will take over.
So rather than arresting our development as a species, you think that it's actually we're going to accelerate it?
It's accelerating.
Ourselves.
The time ahead is as long as the time in the past, but things are going to change faster because of technology than they ever did in the past through natural selection. So I think it's very important to realise that we are certainly not the carbonation, but what we do this century is important, because for the first time there are enough of us, and we're collectively as demanding of energy and resources that we are having an effect on the planet. And the other concern I have is that technology empowers individuals, and I'm also worried about us becoming harder to govern, because small dissident groups empowered by modern technology are going to have more chance to be disruptive than in the past. And so I think that's going to make it very hard indeed to maintain freedom and cooperation.
So it's not just about sort of very large political blocks, but all the different factions that exist in the world.
That's right, because small groups can be more influential and indeed more disruptive if they wish to be, because we are in an interconnected world where we depend on lots of networks that could be disrupted, and where, of course, a few people can have great influence.
And how do you think we can deal with those challenges?
Well, I think we've got to accept that politics is in many ways harder than science.
Yes.
We've got to hope that politicians will deal wisely with problems which are more difficult in many ways than those which their predecessors confronted. And that's why, incidentally, I hope that some of our best students will in fact choose to go into politics, because that's where we need to have very good people. And I'm rather depressed that the prestige of politicians has fallen so low, because the last thing we want to do is to discourage idealistic and able people from going into it.
Yeah. And since you wrote Our Final Century, in those few years, have your views changed at all with the global developments?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I wrote that book about 7 or 8 years ago, and I think the net balance between optimism and pessimism hasn't changed. I would say that I'm a technical optimist, in that I believe that even present technology, and certainly technology we'll have in the next 20 years, should allow everyone by 2050 to have a high quality of life using clean energy and advanced agriculture, etc. So technically I think we should be optimistic, but of course the question is whether that will happen, or whether these hopes will be jeopardized by political conflicts, because even now, of course, we could do far more than we are actually doing to improve the lot of the so-called bottom billion, the people living on less than a pound a day. We could easily do that, and we're not. And so that makes me pessimistic about whether politics will actually lead to the kind of world by 2050 which technology would certainly allow.
Okay, well, yeah. As I think we're about to go off to dinner, perhaps we should wrap up there, and thanks once again for being interviewed.
Yes, well, thank you very much, and I hope to come to Jodrell again, because when I go to Jodrell, I'm always hugely impressed by the place and by the Lovell telescope, because it's wonderful to think that that's been there for over 50 years, and it's now doing wonderful science of a kind that couldn't have been envisioned at all when it was built. At that time, neutron stars weren't known to exist. Einstein's theory was tested to a precision of 10-20% at best, whereas now Jodrell is being used, among other things, to test Einstein's theory to a precision of 1 part in 100,000 by using the binary pulsar.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful development, and it just indicates the marvellous vision which Bernard Lovell showed in designing such a huge instrument. He never foresaw, I'm sure, it would still be doing frontier topics so far into the future.
No, I'm sure. Yeah. Wonderful, thank you very much.
Bye.